integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation.
And Hans, you've been following what this means for Bergdahl's future. Yeah. He was facing the potential, I think, for life in prison, right?
Yeah, we'll try to figure out just what this means for his actual time in prison. It was telegraphed that he would plead guilty. He gave an interview that there's excerpts came out in a documentary. Just this whole idea that he couldn't get a fair trial because Donald Trump, as a campaigner, said a lot of things prejudging the fate of that trial. What we know now, he is pleading guilty. The judge is asking him at this moment in the courtroom whether or not he understands the implications of his plea, and then we'll move to the sentencing side of it.
Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for joining me again today. Today we're talking about the Bo Bergdahl case. Recent, in fact, just hours before this interview, very recent news reports have stated that Bo Bergdahl has pled guilty in military court to both the charges of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy. We won't have the actual sentencing case for another week or two, so we don't know the final outcome of this case, but I'm joined by Butch Bracknell, a friend, colleague, former Marine Corps lawyer, now a NATO lawyer, and we discuss the mechanics of the guilty plea, what we anticipate might happen during the sentencing phase, what ultimate sentence that Bergdahl might receive, and just everything else we can think of. Hope you enjoy it, and thanks for listening. Welcome, Butch. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me again, James. It's been a while.
So for those who didn't hear you previously, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I have to think that your many and varied fans now know who I am, but since I haven't been on in a while, I'll tell you. So you and I served together in active duty for a number of years together, in the same places, but hardly ever at the same time. So I was in active duty. I started as an armor officer and then moved over to being an active duty Marine officer. And I work as the international law attorney at NATO's Allied Command Transformation in Norfolk, Virginia.
Great.
That's all you need to know about me.
Yes, that is all. And these, I think most importantly, though, these are your views, not NATO's or anybody else's, right?
1,000%.
So as we are recording this, we just got information that Bo Bergdahl pled to both of the charges on the charge sheet.
Yes.
This is a little odd, wouldn't you agree?
Well, it's late-breaking news. I mean, talk about being timely, James. Yeah. Yeah, so apparently this morning down at Fort Bragg, he pled to desertion under Article 85, and he also pled to misbehavior before the enemy. None of the media reporting, obviously we weren't there at Fort Bragg. It would have been nice to know and be nice to see a press release or for them to say something, but I haven't found anything online yet suggesting what it is that he actually pled to, other than media reports suggesting that he actually pled to what was on the charge sheet as opposed to some other lesser included offense or something like that. For example, for desertion, he could have pled to an unauthorized absence. A desertion is an unauthorized absence with the added element of an intent to remain away. But apparently, instead of just pleading to just an unauthorized absence or an Army parlance, an AWOL, in the Navy Marine Corps, unauthorized absence, he actually pled to Article 85. So he's admitting to the court that he left and intended to stay away, which I find kind of remarkable. Given a lot of the media coverage over this event, I can't imagine that he really believed he was going to stay away from the Army forever. And that's an essential element. So that this plea, if he actually did plead to Article 85, that in particular intrigues me quite a bit, that he was willing to admit to an intent to stay away.
Well, I think could it also be the alternative element that he was that he left to either remain away or to shirk important service or hazardous duty?
Yeah, maybe that's the theory on which they are pleading, because he certainly – so everything we've heard a bunch of different potential explanations as to why he left. At some point, Bergdahl has posited the fact that he left in order to call attention to what he believed were some important that the conditions in his unit were really, really bad, and he was leaving in order to make a report to some other authority because he didn't trust his chain of command to be able to raise the issues within his own chain of command. He thought it would get squashed or whatever. So in his mind, he came up with this plan where he'd walk through Indian country to some other place in order to make a report about the conditions there. But I mean, I guess it's inescapable that he was shirking important duty because he left his place of duty in a place where the duty was pretty important. So I guess that's the theory behind the plea.
But still, he had to have that intent, and at least from what we've heard from him in his hours of interviews, it was never, or at least he hadn't put forth previously that he was wanted to not do his duty. That's why he left.
Yeah, that's right. But at the end of the day, if he walked away from the place of duty where important duty was occurring, for whatever reason he walked away, he also left with the intent of shirking his duty. Of not performing the duties he was sent there to perform for the purpose of realizing some other end, and that other end was you know, being a whistleblower. I'm using that in a non-technical term, that he was going to go make reports about things that were going on in his unit. So you can do both at once. You can shirk important duty for some reason. Some people might do it because they're cowards. Some people might do it because they're just stressed out, but they're not cowards, but they've reached their breaking point. And some people might do it. In this case, I think he might have done it, or his position is that he did it for the purpose of making these reports. The fact that he was doing it for some quasi-noble purpose, if you wanted to indulge that for a moment, the fact that he was doing it for what he perceived to be a good reason doesn't eliminate the fact that he left his unit while it was on a combat deployment. So, you know, that element is met in that circumstance.
Right. I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I think if Article 85 is viewed like that, that all service is important service, then it's no different from AWOL or UA.
Well, except going AWOL at Camp Lejeune is pretty different from going AWOL in whatever province. Was he in Pektika province?
Yeah.
Of going AWOL where he was. I mean, and that's the distinction that the government on which the government relied was that his duty was hazardous. You can't really have hazardous. You can't really desert for the purpose of avoiding hazardous duty when you're at Camp Lejeune or Camp Pendleton. Shirk important service, I think, has been interpreted over the years as meaning something more than just your day-to-day duties in garrison.
Right.
But that's the theory on which I believe the government was relying.
And I think it's worth it for the listeners to we'll kind of go through. I think it's pretty fair to say that most military lawyers are fairly shocked about what happened today. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's basically a naked plea, right? So
right.
If he pled to everything that was on the charge sheet, usually it's a negotiation, whether it's in a civilian court or a military court. Usually when you're pleading and accepting guilt, it's usually some stuff on the charge sheet goes away. Some other stuff that might have a problematic element in it for the government gets reduced. It's a negotiation. You can't incentivize the defense to come to the table and plead unless you have a super strong case or you're reaching some sort of agreement that takes into account the strengths and weaknesses of each other's case. In this case, it appears he has entered a naked plea, and we can't really tell whether he has negotiated for anything or not. Certainly nothing fell off the charge sheet, so the government's position may have been that, hey, you plead to everything, but there may be a sentence limitation in it for you later. We don't know that, and we won't know that until after he's actually sentenced. So, as you well know, but maybe our listeners don't know, the way it works in the military system is they're going to go forward now and put on a sentencing case. And Bergdahl is going to put on probably a pretty strong mitigation case. I think his attorneys are going to try to share the blame a little bit with the Army for enlisting him in the first place, given his history with the Coast Guard, that he should never have been assigned in a reenlistment code that should have allowed him. They should have looked harder into why he was separated from the Coast Guard, and they probably put him in a position where he was bound to fail. So when he did actually fail, you know, who does that responsibility lie the most on? Does it lie on a kind of a confused, maybe a little bit nutty guy who was certainly raised outside the norms of normal American society? Or does it fall on the institution that had all these resources and the ability to look behind his former enlisted and say, is this really the kind of guy we want to bring into the fold here? So that's, I think that's going to be part of their case in mitigation. I think they'll put on some psychological evidence about maybe having schizoid tendencies. And they'll probably put on some evidence about, you know, that he was trying to actually do something good for the unit, however misguided and however poorly executed it may have been, that he was doing it not because he was a coward, not to hide from his duty, but because of a sense of duty to the unit that he wanted to report whatever it is that he believed was going badly inside the unit. The government, of course, is going to put on some other evidence. They have gotten a pretrial ruling from the judge, Judge Nance, that says they are going to be able to introduce some evidence of injuries sustained by individuals who were involved in the search for him while during the 5 years that he was missing. That's going to be pretty damning evidence. It's better for him that it's going to be in front of a judge than a jury or than a members panel, because a members panel would probably, that would not sit well with a members panel. So the tactical decision to go judge alone here from the very beginning has, in my view, has been kind of the only thing that was on the table reasonably. You know what I'm saying?
Are you hiring? Do you know where to put your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work for you, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidate finding you. It finds the right candidate. It's no wonder 80% of employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smarter way to hire. That's ZipRecruiter.com/military. One more time. Try it out for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. You can find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And as mentioned before, you can try it for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/military.
So they'll go forward with the sentencing case, and then when they get to the end, the judge will pronounce a sentence. And what we don't know is, in our case, in our process, we have this two-step process where then there'll be a sentence limitation that the judge gets to see that has been held secret for him, so it doesn't influence his judgment about the proper and fair sentence to impose. And if that sentence limitation, if he reveals it, he's kind of like a game show where he gets to open it after the fact, and then he'll see what it is that the defense and the government have agreed to. And it could be a limitation that's less than what he awarded, or it could be a limitation that's more than what he awarded if he awards a very slight sentence, in which case it would have no effect.
Now, see, I'm not sure that that's actually the case in this case. So let's go back 18 years now, and let's say that you and I are, I'm the defense attorney, you're the prosecutor at Camp Pendleton, and I'm representing a Marine who was caught using marijuana. Yeah. You and I go into the courtroom, you're the prosecutor, I'm the defense attorney, my client's there, court reporter and the judge are in the court. So the government and my client have signed an agreement to plead to, you know, two charges. And in exchange for that, he has a limitation of, you know, 90 days in jail. Sure. And you're right. That is in a two-part document. The first part the judge would see. Then we put on our case in mitigation. And then there's that cap of 90 days. So like you're saying, if the judge gives 120 days, then
you have 30 days suspended.
Yeah, 30 days of that won't go into effect. Now, that's why I'm kind of questioning whether there is an agreement in Bergdahl's case, or whether it's, like you're saying, just a naked plea. Because
we don't know that. I mean, there's no way to know that until after the sentencing case, right? Neither side is talking about that right now. Having been offered the opportunity to talk about it in the media, neither side has spoken to that right now. So we don't know whether this is a truly naked plea or there is a sentence limitation that has been bargained for. We won't know that until the sentencing hearing, which I believe, James, now is scheduled for the 23rd to start.
Yes, the 23rd of October, 2017. Well,
we will know a lot more in 1 week.
And I'm not, you know, faulting any of the reporters. Sometimes this is the minutia of a case like this. But do we know if the military judge actually accepted his pleas? Because as you were saying before, we go through this pleading in court isn't as simply as saying, yes, you know, I'm guilty. There's got to be that exchange between the judge and the accused to determine if he actually is guilty.
Call it a providence inquiry or a care inquiry. In some state courts, they call it allocution. But you're right. At some point, he actually has to admit all of the elements that are in the offense. And it has to be to a degree that's sufficient to satisfy the military judge, not just that he's accepting guilt, but that he's actually guilty, that he's actually stated facts which don't raise affirmative defenses that haven't been waived, for example. That if he comes in and says something like, yeah, I know, I left my unit and I did it for this reason, et cetera, and I did do it to ensure important duty and things like that, but they are saying in a conclusory fashion that he pled, and therefore one might ascertain from that the judge accepted the plea, and therefore that he was provident, that he allocated with sufficient precision and accuracy to allow the military judge to say, yes, I do believe that you have admitted the elements of the offenses.
I agree with you that we will definitely know more soon, and maybe this just slipped through the reporting, but usually there should have been some, as you said, the providence inquiry that should have been reduced to writing, and especially in a case as detailed as this or as high profile as this that would usually be in that first half of that document.
Exactly. And we don't know any of that stuff. Unless you were sitting at Fort Bragg this morning, which is, you know, 4 hours from where I am and about 40 hours from where you are.
Right. But,
it's very difficult to know the details on, because the reporters, God bless them, but many of them don't have experience in this. So they're covering it like they would any other trial that's happening out in town. And they may or may not know how to report on those kinds of details. And heck, for their audiences, maybe those things aren't important. But for folks who want and care about military law, they are important. It is important to know, was there a stipulation? Was the stipulation read into evidence? Did the judge go through the stipulation and verify every fact in the stipulation with the defendant? We just don't know any of that stuff. Because, like I said, the news reporting is a little bit conclusory. It doesn't quite go to that level of detail we'd like to see.
And I think I've talked to people about this and had questions about it. Having a judge reject a plea is a somewhat common thing. I know I've had it happen with my clients when I was a defense attorney, and I've had it happen when I was a prosecutor. It's not uncommon to have a judge say, yeah, I know you tried to plead guilty today, but I'm not accepting your plea of guilt.
Yeah, I mean, in our experience, most of the time when that happened at Camp Pendleton, it was because there was some, you know, you just had a knucklehead who wasn't a rocket scientist. He was sitting over there at your table, and he couldn't quite get his head around the fact that he needed to admit these things, or for some internal psychological reason, he just can't admit to the wrongfulness of his action. So he'll say, yes, I did, I did element one. Yes, I did element two. Yes, I did element three. Yes, I knew it was wrongful when I did it. But judge, what had happened was, you know, my cousin called, and then they start introducing all these ancillary facts that, and so the judge has to go, okay, are you telling me your cousin forced you to do this thing or blah, 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 which, you know, now they've started to paint out some affirmative defense or some lack of mental capacity capacity. I didn't really know what I was doing, Judge. Instead of sticking to, we haven't agreed upon, you know, you have a colloquy that you need to get through here that is, that will establish your guilt. And when you start bringing in all these stray voltage and these extra facts, you know, sometimes it goes off the rails because the judge will say, no, I'm not satisfied that you are 100% convinced of your own guilt and that you're telling me neutral facts that I can believe. You know, the judge has to be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt as well. When a guy is admitting to you, it's the strongest form of proof known to the law, as it says in the judge's statements each time he gives the a pleading defendant his rights. But it just because it's the strongest form of proof doesn't known to the law doesn't mean it's uncontrovertible. When you start bringing in other extrinsic evidence, it can undermine the strength of that strongest form of proof.
Oh yeah, no. I had a client who worked at the On Base liquor store. Tons of liquor was found at his house. he was trying to plead guilty, but as you're saying, like, just kept mentioning, well, you know, there was friends of mine, and then, you know, I have a cousin who likes alcohol, and sure. and absolutely, the judge rejected it there. And I could see that, at least for one of the greater offenses, the Article 85 desertion, see that kind of being a hurdle in the Bergdahl case.
As long as he was able to admit to having formed the intent to leave his unit and avoid his primary duty in order to go accomplish his other aim, even though it might have been in his mind rightful, it doesn't take away the scienter of walking away from his unit. Knowingly and willfully, and with for the purpose that he knew he was avoiding his duty when he walked away, right? He left his rifle.
Right.
I mean, that's a pretty strong piece of evidence that he avoided, intended to avoid his duty.
Yeah. I agree. I agree for the proof portion. I'm just, it will be interesting to find out on the 23rd. And it's possible that the judge today just said, you know, I understand your pleas. And then, will make a decision on accepting them on the 23rd. You know, there's no necessity that he actually go through all of that today.
That's right. Although, if he were to defer
right.
that until later, that puts the defense in it as a disadvantage. So what happens on the 23rd, if the judge goes, you know, I've been thinking on this and I don't accept your pleas. Government, are you ready to go forward? Now has the defense been proceeding for the past week thinking that we're going to go straight into a sentencing case, and all of a sudden you've got to double back and they've got to do a merits case. So
no,
I hope.
Yeah, you're right. Know. Also, just for judicial economy. I mean, the judge doesn't want to waste his own time. So, yeah, I don't see him doing that and then having the government go forward because you just have an entirely separate set of witnesses. And we all know how much judges hate it when you don't have your witnesses lined up.
This whole thing, the sentencing thing, is going to be super interesting to me. As I can't imagine going in and doing this as a naked plea, but Gene Fidel and his team, I mean, those are some super experienced guys. I can't imagine having not negotiated for some sort of confinement cap, but Fidel's an experienced litigator. Maybe he thinks that the naked plea is the way to go here. I'm trying to get my head around the fact, going to the judge for sentencing is a good move. You could take some risk of irrational sentencing decisions out, right? Because you've got a guy who's seen he knows what a fair sentence looks like more than, you know, he's
right.
A judge, he's a general court martial judge. He's doing, I don't know, scores, if not hundreds of cases a year. He's seeing sentences and he can sort of get a sense for what an appropriate range, although he's not doing a lot of desertion and misbehavior before the enemy cases. He does have, he's able to look at the moral gravity of the conduct and compare it to other offenses and their moral gravity and say, okay, this is kind of this is the range of punishment that looks like. When you have a panel that comes together for one case, it is an absolute crapshoot. You know, you get
right.
a couple of
yeah,
hard dogs on that panel and one, you know, gungy ranger colonel as the panel president who influences the other panel members, you could wind up with a substantial, I mean, literally you could wind up with life in prison here.
Right. And not only does that judge do that many cases, by the time you become a judge, you've spent at least somewhere between 15 and 20 years around military justice your entire career. So you have that sense of what actually garners, you know, life in prison. And those are usually murders and rape cases.
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be interesting to me after, you know, the initial investigation by the Major General Dahl came out with findings that said that he believed, you know, this thing should be adjudicated at a forum below a general court-martial, and that no additional confinement should occur because of his assessment of the conditions under which Bergdahl was confined for 5 years by the terrorists, essentially, in Pakistan. And now you have the potential that he's going to draw. I just got to think that the judge is going to come out and really take that into account, assuming that Gene Fidel can get General Dahl's initial recommendation in front of the judge. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Colonel Nance is going to consider General Dahl's statements on sentencing as to what he believed at the time that a fair resolution would be. That's an interesting issue, is whether he'll be able to. I don't even know if they've litigated that yet.
Yeah, I think he should be able to, but you're right, that would be interesting to see how you would get that before him, but it's possible that Lieutenant General Dahl could just, you know, write a letter in support. And as you're saying, I mean, Lieutenant Generals, there's maybe, what, 40 of them in all of the Army? I mean, that is a very senior individual.
Yeah, he was a major general when he did the investigation. But you're right, the Army has seen fit to move him on from there. He's now General Ken Dahl is now the commander at U.S. Army Installations, MCOM they call it, whatever that means, Installation Management Command or something like that. So he has responsibility over all the installations in the Army. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they get his recommendation in front of the panel. I mean, what if he says no? What if he says no? You know. I was willing to take that stand because, you know, when I did the investigation a few years ago, but because the Army said, hey, go out and investigate this thing and write down your conclusions, write down what you believe to be the right answer here. That doesn't mean he's on Team Bergdahl. It just means that he answered the question that the Army asked him. So I don't know if they'll be successful in getting Dahl to write a letter other than unless the letter they ask him to write is, could you please restate for the military judge your conclusions from your prior investigation as to what you thought was a just and fair outcome at the time.
Yeah, and I could see this. I've heard from sources that they expect the pre-sentencing case to take the full 2 weeks.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I would imagine the government has stacked up quite a bit of evidence. I think that they're going to hear from I believe they have three witnesses that they've been able to tie injuries. One was a SEAL and two others were Army, I believe. Where they've been able to tie pretty significant injuries back to the search for Bergdahl. And the defense team's position on that has been, in every one of those cases, they had a mission other than just searching for Bergdahl. Nobody went out on Operation Search for Bergdahl. They were other operations where they had other targets and other aims in their mission. And, oh, by the way, we're also looking for Bergdahl. In other words, he's also going to put on some evidence of the fact that one of the missions was very poorly planned. And so in terms of causation, is the search for Bergdahl causation to those individuals' injuries? Yeah, sure. But what about the really bad planning, mission planning that went into the execution of the mission? That's a pretty big causal factor, too. So can you really hang the full weight of that around Bergdahl's neck when you ought to be looking at your own internal planning processes?
That also makes me tend to think that, again, that this is a naked plea. Because otherwise, if you're the government, you would have, you know, required a lot of stipulation about that just to, you know, relieve the burden of having to put on so many witnesses.
Yeah. Well, again, we'll know a lot more about this on the 23rd. It's really hard. I wish we were at Camp Lejeune today. I wish we could have, because, you know, you and I could have walked in and sat down. It's just kind of expensive to fly from California for me to take a day off from work to go down and sit in there. And you rely on the media to be able to tell you these things. But again, if those guys don't have experience, you're using general assignment reporters to cover something that's pretty specific and technical. So they may not have known exactly which procedures to describe with accuracy. Again, there may have been a stipulation and that may have been acknowledged today during the pleas in a way and entered in as an appellate exhibit. And we wouldn't know that because no reporter has really told us that because they don't know that's important to talk about, you know?
Right, right. I would like to see the Army's courtroom there at Bragg. As our experience in the Marine Corps shows, our courtrooms weren't the grandest affair.
Yeah.
They were usually converted old barracks that...
broom closets. Dirty carpet and dingy lighting, you know.
that were usually put together with a couple of trial counsel who had maybe worked for an uncle one summer as a carpenter. With, I think
someone,
Our largest courtroom had, what, maybe three benches for people to to sit. I mean, it was not an exquisite affair.
Yeah, I mean, when I used to go and see the courtroom that was down in Guantanamo that they built, I looked at that place and I went, "Holy cow!" They built all this for basically one set of trials. It was way better than anything we'd ever seen in the Marine Corps. You know, I mean, it looked like a district court courtroom. It was pretty nice. It was befitting the gravity of the proceedings that were in front of it. You're right. I'll bet that the Army courtrooms down at Bragg are pretty nice. I don't know, having never seen those, but I've seen some Army courtrooms, and they've always stacked up favorably compared to our facilities.
think of Camp Petla when we're there in, what, the late 90s, up at Echo, or up at Delta in the northern part of the base. That was literally like somebody's garage that we made a little, set some desks up and decided, hey, look, this will be our courtroom.
It was literally one step better than a maintenance shed. I did a 32 up there from some guys from 4th LAR in about 2000, and it was raining, and I had to put buckets in the courtroom to catch the water while we were doing a 32. And I was new to the game then, and this is, I don't know, my first, second, third, fourth, 32 or something. And I'm sitting there, and, you know, this lieutenant, it was a first lieutenant that was sitting in the 32, and he had hired Kevin McDermott as his attorney, and he's sitting there. And I'm looking over these buckets that are literally catching water, and I'm going, oh, my God, this is the precursor to basically a felony. You know, the government wants to go forward in a felony trial to this guy, and we're sitting in a courtroom where it's raining inside the building.
Well, I mean, it was a beautiful Quonset hut at one point. Well, Butch, I thank you for being on this morning, and we'll stay up to date. I think that we've talked about everything that we could talk about today.
Well, that's the thing. We'll know so much more after this sentencing hearing. We'll know so much more about whether there was negotiated for a sentence limitation. We'll know so much more about, I don't know if we'll know in 2 weeks what the sentence is. If I were Colonel Nance, even if the sentencing case had closed, I would want a couple of days to think about this one. The entire Army is looking at this case, and he's a military judge. He's a colonel. He's probably at the end of his career. The ability to influence him is pretty low. But at the end of the day, he's still in the Army. He's still got to go, you know, he's still got to go look all these people in the eye. So he's going to want to think this one over and not deliver any rash judgments. It will be so interesting to see what kind of decision comes out of this. Do you have any predictions?
My previous prediction was 30 days and forfeiture, because I was going along the theory that it was just a short-term UA, that he was then in the hands of the Haqqani network. What's your prediction?
I don't think he gets anything like life. And you hear, you know, if you ever, you know, the first rule of Facebook and Instagram and those things is don't read the comments or you know, all the news,
God,
don't read the comments. I mean, and there are some real true patriots out there that are, you know, he should be executed. He should have been summarily executed and blah, blah, blah. And you go, oh, my God. What are we doing here? I don't think he's going to get life. I don't think he's going to get anything like life. I think he may get a term of years tacked on to. I mean, let's be clear. The quality of the confinement that he was in with the Haqqani network was horrific. It was horrific. It wasn't anything. It was 10 times worse than the worst jail in the worst state in the Union 50 years ago. I mean, it was really, really bad. He was cramped up in a little bitty cage, fed hardly anything. You could see how gaunt he was after the prisoner exchange. You know, it was a really bad, it was almost like he was had been kept in a Viet Cong POW camp or something like that. So he underwent some pretty substantial hardship when he was imprisoned by the Haqqanis. I think the judge will take that into account. And General Dahl did. He said, you know, there's nothing really the Army can do to him that is any worse than what has already been done to him. I think that the judge will probably tack on a couple of years. I don't think he'll get time served. I think he'll get some additional punishment, but I don't think it's going to be anything like what the crazies are calling for.
Right. Well, thank you, my friend. And we will, now that we've put both of our predictions down and they're recorded for posterity, the next time we're together, the loser has to buy the other a drink.
I know. We may both look like idiots in about 2 weeks.
Or if we
may have both misread this badly.
Yeah, if we don't already.
Yeah.
Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Talhan, she takes care of everything. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.